Hello and welcome to the Knee Pain Guru. This is Bill Paravano, and in today's podcast, the question comes up whether or not you're deciding to have knee surgery, and that is a big decision to make. And the determination of whether or not to have knee surgery can be a very big life-altering decision. Today we have a very special guest. He's a retired knee and hip specialist who doesn't necessarily think surgery is always the correct option. And I thought this was a great opportunity. Listen to his resume. He graduated from the New York Medical College and did a surgical internship and general surgery residency at the Medical College of Virginia. He's had training at St. Luke's Hospital Center, at the New England Baptist Hospital, at Tufts University with a fellowship in adult joint reconstruction. He's had a private orthopedic surgery practice for the hip and the knee for almost 25 years. He's held administrative and academic positions at St. Catherine's of Siena in Smithtown, New York, at University of New York at Stony Brook, at Columbia University in New York City. He's also had fellowships with the American College of Surgeons, the International College of Surgeons, the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, the American Academy of Neurologic and Orthopedic Surgeons, and the American Academy for Postgraduate Surgery. He's also published 7 books, including one titled How to Avoid Knee Surgery. And most recently, he's the medical director of Dr. Bill's Clinic and Dr. Bill's Favorite Formulas, Incorporated. I would like to extend a warm welcome to Dr. William Thomas Stillwell.
Hi there.
Hey, Dr. Bill. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How about yourself, Bill?
Really well, really well. I'm so happy that you're on the call today, and there's so many questions I want to get in and ask you about, you know, whether or not to have knee surgery. So obviously you have a ton of experience. You've seen the surgery, the knee surgery, from the other end of the spectrum, meaning you're the one actually doing these knee surgeries. From your experience, why is it so important to avoid knee surgery?
Well, first of all, any surgery that you do is an invasive procedure, which means, unfortunately, since we weren't created with zippers, we've got to be able to get inside the body. And that means making some sort of an incision. Now, it can be a little incision or a big incision, but at the end of the day, it's an injury to the body. And any injury is causing pain and inflammation and swelling. And even though it's done for a good cause when it's properly indicated, it nevertheless is injury in and of itself. So you never want to do it unless it's absolutely necessary. As a general principle, you want to give your body a chance to heal itself if it can. Now, why? Because any surgery, in effect, is an after-factory modification, if you think about it. And the original, the original equipment you've been provided is superior to any man-made materials or any man-made design. And it's designed to approximate natural surfaces and natural functions. Now, the first principle of medicine is first, do no harm. So any surgery that you do is not only an injury, but it has inherent risks. And these risks are like things like infection or fibrosis, which is where your knee gets stiff from extra scar tissue that grows up in there and it limits your motion. And in cases of joint replacements, you've got a host of other things. Such an infection, by the way, is top of the list because it's a pound or two of artificial material that you're carrying around in your body. There are other things involved like loosening, malposition, meaning the components aren't put on quite right, or the malalignment, which means that they're angled slightly wrong, or they're rotated slightly wrong. And infection, if it should occur, can lead to osteomyelitis, which is an infection in the bone. And that is a very, very bad complication, because once you have that, you may be able to control it. But, you know, we have a saying in orthopedics that osteomyelitis is forever, because it's never considered cured. And the reason for that is something that people don't realize. Bone is mostly non-living material. Now, just think about that for a minute. There are bone cells that are alive, but they produce non-living material, and that's what gives your bone rigidity and strength.
Mm-hmm.
You can think of a bone like an apartment house, where the cells are living in the apartments, but the structure itself is not alive. So the cells act to create and maintain the bone, but the vast majority of stuff that the cells have built is just inert. It's just lying there, and although it's turned over, your skeleton replenishes itself once every 2 years. Nevertheless, because it's non-living material, if germs get in there, they can hide, and the body's defenses can't get at them. And that's the reason I go into all of this, is because people say, well, you know, how can you get something that, you know, really can't be considered cured? And that's the reason. It's because any of the orthopedic tissues, the ligaments, the tendons, and most especially the bones, are essentially non-living products of the cells. And because they're non-living, the bloodstream and the intrinsic protective capabilities of the body can't get at the germs. Mm. So even if it can kill a lot of them, as few of these guys may hide out, and they may come back at a later time to cause more trouble. So as you can see, there are a whole lot of reasons why you don't undertake surgery lightly. You've got to do it for the right reasons, and if you can get by without having to do it and still get rid of somebody's pain and restore their function, you're way ahead of the game. And I'm telling you this as a surgeon.
Yeah, that's certainly has a lot of pull. Just curious why most surgeons, it's in their best interest. It's like job security to do more surgery. What is your angle? Why are you coming from a place of wanting to see people where it wouldn't be job security for someone who's a surgeon?
That's actually an excellent question. And the reason seems counterintuitive, but oddly enough, you remember I said that you got to differentiate between necessary and unnecessary surgeries.
Yes.
Well, the fact is that there are plenty of necessary surgeries, things that, just to use an extreme example, let's say some guy gets gangrene of his foot, okay? You may have to amputate that foot to save the rest of the body. I mean, there are times when if you don't do surgery, somebody is dead or they lose a limb. You know, that's a very dramatic example, but that's what I'm talking about. As opposed to somebody who's got knee pain, they don't really know why, so they say, well, let's open them up and see. Well, you know, that's ridiculous. The fact is, from a surgeon's point of view, if you're a good surgeon and you're an ethical surgeon, there's plenty of real surgery out there, but you've got to skim those cases off from the people who would get better without surgery. And oddly enough, if you get the reputation in whatever place you're practicing of being a conservative surgeon, that is somebody who doesn't operate at the drop of a hat, but basically has to be forced into it by the proof, that you have to prove that somebody needs it, you develop a reputation as a reliable, ethical guy, and the other doctors end up referring you more cases that actually do need surgery. So that's how it's, in fact, in my interest, okay?
Got it.
But more than that, there's the ethics involved. I would venture to say that 90% or more of the people who were ever sent to me, I ended up not doing surgery on them. I treated them during, and I was chairman of the department, so I had access to lots and lots of potential patients. If a patient was sent to me for surgery and I thought they didn't need it, I would say to them and their doctors, say, look, let's try this first. We have nothing to lose and everything to gain by, you know, trying the more conservative approach. And I would use alternative as well as conventional methods. And, you know, a lot of the other docs would make fun of me, of course, but nobody could match my results. In over 23 years of actually doing thousands upon thousands of cases, I had two deep infections. One of them was in a diabetic, and the other one was in somebody with rheumatoid arthritis. And these are both diseases that involve poor microcirculation. That is, the blood supply to the tissues is lousy in those diseases. So they're a setup for infection. And when you're talking thousands upon thousands of cases, I think that's pretty good shooting.
Yeah, well, absolutely. That's way less than a 1%. 1%.
It's like thousandths of a percent, which is not bad. And 1% is considered sort of the benchmark.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of infection. And now that's not to say that I didn't treat infections, because sometimes people would be sent to me with infections and I would have to treat those, but I'm talking about my own after a clean, uncomplicated surgery. There's a certain number of people who they don't have very good resistance. Their immune systems are not particularly good, or they have concomitant disease, you know, like diabetes or rheumatoid arthritis. And these people are setups for infection. But anyway, that's a record that I'm actually very proud of. And, you know, the other doctors in town saw that, and even though they would kid me about, you know, using things like intravenous supplements and stuff like that, mega doses of vitamins, magnetic therapy and stuff, they'd roll their eyes, but they would also send the patients because I got results. And mm-hmm. at the end of the day, if you're getting excellent results, nobody wants to rock the boat.
right, exactly. So that's phenomenal, and that's so honestly refreshing to hear that a medical doctor is open to those types of options. So I'd like to ask you, as far as avoiding knee surgery, what are the types of knee surgeries that you were able to commonly veer patients away from? Like, they came into you and they said, I had torn my meniscus, I had torn the ligament in my knee, I have knee pain, I have arthritis in my knee. And what were the situations, what were the scenarios, how would those look that you would say, well, let's do this first?
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, actually everything that you mentioned, I've turned patients away from surgery. And the reason is because the ones that I turned away were all unnecessary surgeries. There's that word again. Mm-hmm. Here's what I mean. Any procedure that does not have a proven, rock-solid clinical indication, and that means a rational, specific, proven reason to do it, so that it's likely to work to resolve the problem, be it pain or instability or a lack of function, are cases where you want to try something other than surgery. See, surgery is like a rifle. It's not a shotgun, okay? You have to have a specific goal, a specific target that you're going to shoot at, okay? And that's when you get the best result. When you have a specific reason, you have a specific modality or a procedure that you can do that is aimed at solving that problem, then you're very, very likely to be successful. But if it's vague, you don't have that kind of rock-solid proof, then you're much better off not taking the plunge, because, you know, look, it's like a haircut. You can always cut more, but you can't put it back once you cut it off.
Right.
You see?
That
was the principle I always went by. And the other thing I want to emphasize is that you have to recognize that there are cases in which surgery is absolutely necessary. And, you know, a few things other than the gangrene that I mentioned are any type of infection with pus in the joint, a compound fracture or an unstable fracture, like if you break your shin bone, you know, and it comes piercing through the skin and you get germs in there. Because of that danger of developing osteomyelitis, absolutely you got to clean that up surgically. It's mechanical. Anytime there's a complete rupture of a ligament, so much so that the joint is completely unstable and it opens, you know, I mean, you just can't put any weight on it. You can't use it. If there's a focal complete cartilage loss, like the surface of a joint has a crater in it, okay? You see this many times with sports figures or with a gunshot wound where somebody has a focal area maybe the size of a dime or a nickel where there's no cartilage left. It's like a crater right down to bare bone. Any of those things are indications in which you can really help somebody with surgery. If you have recurrent dislocation of a kneecap where it keeps popping out of the joint and somebody just can't do anything because it just keeps doing that, or if you have an unstable tear of a meniscus or a locked knee or an aneurysm in a blood vessel, all of these are examples of absolutely necessary surgery. But in cases where there's vague pain or there's nothing that you can prove that's causing the pain, you're so much better off backing off, say, hey, listen, let's try these exercises. Let's try, you know, this type of herb or this type of medication, or let's alter your diet and see what happens. If you get better, that's great. You know, if you win big. And if you lose, you're no worse off because you can always go back and do surgery if you need to. But the philosophy that I always followed was, give the body a chance. You have the capability of healing yourself under many, many circumstances. And if you give the body the chance, you'll find out right quick whether or not it's going to work or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I love the analogy you used about the surgery is like a rifle, not a shotgun. You have to have something lined up in your sights to see in order to be able to address it. And if you're just trying to do this shotgun approach to see what happens, then that's not an indication that surgery is needed.
You get it. That's exactly correct.
One of the things that, and I help people with knee pain as well, and one of the disturbing things that I'll hear is that I'll have a client that'll say, well, my knee hurts, and the doctors don't know what it is. We figured, well, we'll just go in and take a look to see what's going on, meaning they're going to do some type of surgery, whether it's actually opening up the knee or an arthroscopic keyhole type of surgery where they're just looking. And is there any indication from your experience that you would be able to see something from opening up the knee, going into through an arthroscopic or keyhole type of surgery that you couldn't see on an X-ray, a CT scan, or an MRI?
As a matter of fact, there is, but they're not common. I'll give you an example. There's a disease called pigmented villonodular synovitis. Okay, it's a mouthful. Okay, we don't go through that. We usually just say PVNS. Okay, and what this is an odd disease where the lining of the joint, there's a membrane that lines all synovial joints called the synovium, and the job of the synovium normally is to produce a couple of drops of joint fluid, both as a lubricant, but mainly to nourish the cartilage. P- the cartilage is that rubbery, shiny, white coating that covers all of the bones. And it's a miraculous substance because if you rub two pieces of cartilage together, it's been measured as having less friction than two ice cubes rubbing together. Mm. And it's also very tough. It's designed to last most of your life under normal circumstances. But it's a primitive tissue. It lacks a blood supply, and it lives by sucking up these juices in the synovial fluid. And because it lacks a blood supply, if you damage it or break it in some way, it cannot heal itself. That's the fundamental fact that we deal with. And when that gets taken to an extreme, then you start calling it arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if these days nobody just opens up the whole knee, okay, they would probably scope the knee. And there are times when that PVNS will show up as kind of a bubbly appearance in the bone that gives you a hint on an X-ray. But many times it's early in the disease and it's causing pain and swelling and fluid and nothing shows. And under those circumstances, an arthroscopy where you take a peek inside the knee through tiny little quarter-inch incisions it can be helpful. But that does not preclude trying conservative things first. In other words, I wouldn't even suggest doing an arthroscopy until I had tried a whole host of conservative things from all across the medical spectrum, conventional and alternative. And if those things did not work and we're still scratching our heads, that might be an indication to say, okay, let's take a look and see if there's something that just isn't showing. And if you go in and you look through a scope and you see this membrane is swollen and bright red, because remember, you can't see this on an X-ray.
Mm-hmm.
You might see it on an MRI, a magnetic scan, but then again, you may not.
Mm-hmm.
Under those circumstances, it's not unreasonable to take a look, but only after you've exhausted much more conservative options.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you're a proponent of diet, and there are foods that you can eat that actually cause inflammation.
That's
in the body.
Exactly right. The chief culprit really is like red meat, and I love red meat. Okay, but the problem is that it has to do with the balance of fats in our diet. Today we have a lot of polyunsaturated fat that is not healthy if you get too much of it, and those would be the omega-6 fatty acids. And chief among those is something called arachidonic acid, and if you eat a lot of red meat, you create a lot of arachidonic acid in your body. Now, arachidonic acid is the precursor chemically of substances called prostaglandins. And prostaglandins are chemicals that occur in the tissues, and they are pro-inflammatory. That is to say, they cause inflammation in the body, and they directly stimulate the naked nerve endings in the tissues. So they stimulate these fibers, and you feel this as pain and inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
So by cutting just the simple expedient of cutting back on the red meat, you will reduce the amount of pain that you have if, for example, you have a chronic inflammatory condition like arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can see this for yourself. If you have a nice juicy hamburger or a big steak and you know you've got arthritis, I guarantee you the next day, if you don't do something to counter that, by, say, omega-3 fatty acids to try to balance it, you will feel a little more aching in your joints than you experienced, you know, as a normal level.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one thing that I would recommend that people who have chronic inflammatory conditions do. Cut back a bit on the red meat, or if you are going to have it, then try to balance it with a little fish oil or something like that to try to get it closer to the 1-to-1 ratio between omega-6 and omega-3 fatty acids that's ideal in nature.
Mm-hmm. And of course, this is a simple adjustment that someone can make in their diet that's going to end up as being less knee pain.
Exactly.
That can appear with the, this inflammation that's beginning. You're talking about the where the scope, the doctor who's proposing to do an arthroscopy on the knee would not be necessary just by a simple change in the diet.
Exactly.
That seems to be would make sense. That would be the way most everyone who would try to avoid knee surgery would want to go, making a little adjustment in the diet. So, Dr. Bill, what is the most common type of knee surgery that was easiest to avoid? And in your experience and the number of years that you had as a surgeon and all of the experiences that you had, which one was the most common and easiest to avoid?
Well, overall, I would say arthroscopy, and arthroscopy for what we've been discussing, which is ill-defined knee pain. That is, you've got pain, but you really don't know what's causing it. And, you know, some surgeons will say, as you alluded to before, well, what the hell, let's go and take a look. Yeah, it's easy for him. He's not the one getting the surgery.
Right.
Incidentally, I do want to bring up one thing. I've had knee surgery myself. I had an arthroscopy in one knee, and that was after I tried all of these other things, and I said, you know what, I just can't live like this. And I had a torn meniscus, and I had it taken out. And I want to tell you something. It's not a picnic. It's kind of like, a man can't really appreciate having a baby. You know what I mean? So it's... If you have had surgery, you get a whole different perspective on what your patients are going through than if you haven't. And what I found is that people who have arthroscopies for ill-defined knee pain often don't get better. And, of course, they're assuming the risks of surgery, which are intrinsic to the procedure. So you're taking risks that could make you worse without a clearly defined reason to do it. Now, mm-hmm. One case that comes to mind, when I was a young surgeon, because we all start out that way, right? I had a case of a young man. He was about 17, athlete in school, nice boy, and he had a positive MRI scan. And I said, oh, this is terrible. Look, he's got this big tear, and... if we leave that there, that's going to cause him to develop arthritis, which, in fact, if he had a big, displaceable, mechanically unstable tear, it would be the case. So mm-hmm. I scoped him, and during the arthroscopy, imagine my surprise, I found a completely normal meniscus. Now, this points out a very important lesson. MRI scans are terrific. They are not 100% accurate. On the medial or the inside of the knee, the one closest to the other knee, your accuracy level, depending on the size and the type of lesion, can be between 90 and 95% accurate, which is pretty good, but it's not 100%. On the lateral or the outside of the knee, because of the anatomical complexities, the accuracy rate drops to 60 to 65%, which is only a little bit better than flipping a coin.
Right.
So that's exactly what I learned there, is that I'd fallen into that trap. Now, as an ethical surgeon, naturally I'm not going to remove a perfectly normal meniscus because a test tells me one thing, but my own eyes and my own feeling, because you touch these things with probes. I said, that's a normal meniscus. What the hell is going on? So what I did do is I found that the lining of his joint was swollen and it was inflamed, and he had a shelf, a flap, if you will, of the synovium, the lining of the joint, and that flap was flipping in and out of his joint behaving like a torn meniscus.
So
even though the MRI was falsely positive, that's what they call a false positive, when it really isn't there, but it looks like it's there on the test, I did find a reason why he was having the symptoms. And I removed that, and then I went out and I had to explain to the family. I said, look, I'm not going to take out a normal structure. I'm not even going to touch the normal structure. But here's what I did find, and I cut this away, and I believe that this will solve his problem. However, what I learned from that is that, you know what, I might have been able to reduce that swollen membrane without having to subject him to surgery. And then if that were to fail, that would be the time to then say, okay, we've tried everything, and it's still there, it's still causing trouble. Now let's go in and take a look and see if there's something we can remove. See, so they say there are old surgeons and bold surgeons, but no old bold surgeons, because you learn from experience. And that was one case that stood out in my memory, that here was a kid who might have done just as well without the surgery. Now, another thing that I found was something that you could easily avoid was an arthroscopy for osteoarthritis. Now, there have been a number of studies. The most recent one was like two Septembers ago in the New England Journal of Medicine. They came out with a landmark article that basically demonstrated that when people have osteoarthritis, arthroscopy, if you're only doing it for the arthritis, doesn't add anything. They divided a bunch of people into two groups, and they were otherwise well-matched, and they were randomly assorted. And they did one group with just medication and exercise in the form of physical therapy. And in the other one, they did arthroscopy to clean the joint out and do what's called a debridement, which is a fancy French term that just means a house cleaning. You kind of cut away inflamed synovium, you suck any fragments of cartilage out, and you smooth out any areas that are shredded and damaged. And then they had medicine and physical therapy. And they compared the results, and they found there was statistically no difference between them. And what that meant was that the arthroscopy didn't add a damn thing except the risks of surgery. So at the present time, the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons does not recommend arthroscopy for arthritis unless there's another reason to do it. For example, a loose body in a joint, or a potential infection, or a mechanical problem like something that is, you know, locking the joint or clicking in and out or giving way, mechanical signs.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, even partial or total knee replacements can be delayed if not totally avoided. You can do it by different kinds of exercises, like the type of thing that you do and that I do, and the injections they have of what's called viscosupplementation, where they use a portion of synovial fluid called hyaluronic acid, and they inject this into these arthritic joints, and it can buy somebody, when it works, and it doesn't always, but 75 to 80% of the time, it will reduce pain enough that person does not need the surgery right then and there. You may buy up to 6 to 12 months, depending on the person, if it works. And the beauty is, you haven't burned any bridges. You can go back and inject the guy again if he wanted to, you know, delay surgery. Now, it won't address mechanical problems, but in terms of sheer pain, you can delay this for some several times before you're finally forced, you know, to do something, you know, in a procedure.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the most common things and that are easiest to avoid, I would say.
Mm. And I really like the distinction between, and this is kind of flown into the next question that I'd like to ask you, the misconception between knee surgery and knee pain, and you've you've been touching on it along today, but the distinction, what I'm getting is that just because you have knee surgery doesn't necessarily mean the knee pain will go away.
Exactly. That's right.
The knee surgery is going to address the mechanical problem. Like you gave a list earlier as far as the a compound fracture, a complete rupture of the ligament, complete cartilage loss. You use the example of the sports figure, the gunshot wound. Recurring dislocation of the kneecap, where the knee locks, where
mm-hmm.
there's pus present. So that's like an indication of a mechanical problem, something that you could line the rifle up and address specifically. However, in terms of the pain, you may fix the mechanical problems. However, on the other side of that, there's a whole element of addressing the knee pain.
Exactly.
And that's where it begins to get kind of tricky, actually,
mm-hmm.
as far as what is, indicated as a mechanical problem or what is indicated, as it's just pain in the knee. So is there anything that I didn't, in reviewing kind of what you had talked about, that you would like to add to that?
Well, you had... What you're basically asking me is, when is surgery really necessary, right?
Pretty much.
Okay. Well, the simplest answer is, to my mind, intractable pain that is refractory to all conservative, non-operative measures. Anytime you have pain that just isn't getting better, no matter what you do, which is what all that fancy stuff means, then that's one indication. Provided that you can identify the cause. Another indication would be a disabling mechanical sign like buckling or giving way of the knee that's recurrent and repetitive. And the reason that that's, important is because it's not only annoying and it may be painful, but if your knee gives out, for example, on a curb when you are in front of speeding traffic or you're waiting for a train, or you're at the head of a flight of stairs, it can actually be lethal. You
mm-hmm.
fall in front of a speeding train, you're gone. So these things have more than just, the local problem of having pain or giving way. I mean, they are potentially dangerous to your existence.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you've got instability or a locking of the joint where you simply can't unlock it, where there's something mechanical stuck in there, like the stick in an alligator's mouth, that must be removed, that is an appropriate indication. And if there's progressive bone loss and deformity of the knee, then that's another indication. For example, when you get a knee that has no cartilage left, the bone is now touching the other bone. But what many people don't realize, excuse me, is that over time, the bone, because it's high friction, it doesn't have that lubricating factor of the cartilage anymore, it begins wearing away the opposing bone, like two rocks rubbing together. You get two flat rocks and a pile of sand. That happens inside your knee. And when you lose more bone on one side than the other, you start getting either a severe bow leg deformity or a severe knock knee deformity. And those things indicate that you're losing the substance of your bone. And those are all indications for, intervening surgically. Because if it's inevitable, then the earlier you get to it, the more you have to work with. It's kind of
mm-hmm.
like being a sculptor. If you've got a big block of marble, you have all different options of what type of statue you might want to carve, okay? But as you begin removing chunks of the marble, you limit your options more and more and more. And when you're talking about somebody's life and their function, you want to, if you don't have any choice, then you want to intervene early. So you have to approach this like a detective and say, okay, what is the problem, and what is now causing the problem, and what are the many, what are the, of the options that I have available to me to try to solve the problem, what is the least invasive? And if that doesn't work, it's like climbing a ladder. You go to the next step, and then the next step. And all the way at the top, after you've exhausted everything else, is the surgical step. But you don't leap to the top of a ladder. You take it one step, one rung at a time. And that's the way that I've always approached it in my career. And I had pretty damn good record. So I think that argues for that approach.
Mm-hmm. So question for you, and I've worked with clients that have had, when they've, the doctors, they were diagnosed with arthritis in both knees.
Mm-hmm.
However, one knee, they both look the same on the MRI that was taken. They look identical. However, there's only pain in one knee.
Mm-hmm.
What is your take on that?
Well, there may well be something in that one knee that is different than the other, but you can't see it.
Mm-hmm.
You can have, you and I have discussed the possibility of tension and compression stresses, but more than those mechanical stresses, they act upon surfaces in the joint. And we feel everything through nerves, and the nerves are present in the bone, which is protected from them normally by the cartilage coating.
Mm-hmm.
And if you remove that cartilage coating, you are now overstimulating the nerves. And a simple way for lay people to think of this is if you've ever skinned your elbow or your knee, you know, when you fell as a kid, if you've ever noticed, a scrape hurts a lot more than a cut. And the reason is surface area. If you abrade, or what we call in the trade, desquamate, you remove the surface skin, and you have a broad area that is now exposed. All these little tiny nerve endings are exposed now. And the more of them that are exposed, the more it hurts. Whereas in a cut, It may even be deep, but it doesn't hurt that much because the surface area is very small by comparison.
Mm-hmm.
So there may be things that you cannot see on an X-ray or any objective finding that are present in one knee and not in the other. And then there are times when you have what's called referred pain, where the pain really isn't in the knee; it's just felt there. But you might have a herniated disc in your back, for example, that's stimulating a nerve root that goes to that side of the body. And you feel it in the knee, but its cause is really in the spine.
Hmm.
Or if you may have a disease in the hip right above the knee. Pain is generally referred downstream. That is, if you have pain in the hip, you may feel it in the knee. But if you have disease in the knee, it generally doesn't go up to the hip. It may refer down the leg, down to the ankle, but it generally goes downstream. And so those are just some possibilities as to why somebody might have pain in one side and not the other, even though they look identical. The fact is they're not identical. They only look that way because you can't see the factors that are causing the pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, on to more like financial reasons to avoid mm-hmm. knee surgery.
Sure.
Some of the costs associated with knee surgery, and I know you retired about 8 years ago, so the specific costs may not be available, and of course different areas of the country or areas of the world are going to be different, but just if you could kind of go over some of the different aspects of
sure.
that other than, you know, just the surgery, what are we looking at as far as costs go?
Well, as you point out, yeah, I've been out of the loop for a while. But in there, I can give you a few general ideas and give you a ballpark figure of what you're looking at. Your listeners need to understand that many of these costs are covered by insurance if you happen to have health insurance. But there's still that roughly 20% or more that comes out of your pocket. In general, the better the surgeon, the higher his fee, which is, you know, pretty much reasonable, right? I mean, you get what you pay for.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking at an arthroscopy, just surgeon's fee now, I would say you're probably looking at somewhere between, on an average, I'd say between $2,000 and $5,000 for the surgeon. And then you're looking at probably double that for the outpatient surgery center, since most of these cases are outpatient. That is, you do the surgery, you go home. So that's, say, for arthroscopy. Now, mind you, if you are 65 and older and you are on Medicare, you need to understand that Medicare fees are artificially reduced by the government. That is, they've fixed these prices and they have suppressed them. And it is so extreme. You know, you hear politicians talk about this and you don't realize, you know, really what they're saying. But I commanded literally 10 times what the Medicare rate was for a hip replacement. Now, just think about that for a minute. Now, in addition to a surgeon's fee, you have in the bigger cases, which would be a joint replacement, for example, or a joint revision, which is a redo of a total hip or a total knee that failed, which is a much, much bigger surgery, you need an assistant. The assistant gets 20 to 25% of the surgeon's fee. Then you have a hospital stay and all of the hospital costs, including the implants and so forth. You're probably looking at a cost of around $30,000 in the United States, plus or minus, you know, but that's a rough figure, a good chunk of which, say 80% or so, is going to be covered by insurance. And there is a wider discrepancy between what Medicare and some insurance plans will pay an institution like a hospital or an outpatient surgery center and what they will pay the surgeon. Generally, they take a lot of this out of the hide of the surgeon. And then in addition to those fees, you've got anesthesia. Now, anesthesia, we always used to joke and say any fool can knock you out, but the reason you're paying is because they wake you up. So, and many of these things can be done with what's called conscious sedation, which is where they put you in kind of a twilight sleep. It's like you've had, you know, quite a few margaritas too many. And then they numb the knee with local anesthetic, and they give you this conscious sedation. That's how I had my surgery done. And every single time I've had that done for one procedure or another, I've always said as I'm coming out of it, you know, I really need to drink more, you know, because I really don't, and it really feels great, I must say. But it's there's a fee for that as well. On top of that, then you've got lost wages because you're out of work for a certain period of time. And the recovery varies between people, and it depends on the magnitude of the procedure and what was done. So, for example, if somebody had a simple arthroscopy, in and out, no bone work done, just, say, a torn meniscus fixed, you might be on crutches for, oh, let's say, a few days to a week. Mm-hmm. And you're going to need physical therapy, which is additional, you know, fees and down the road, normally for between, say, 8 and 12 weeks. And that all of that, depending on the type of job that you have, whether it's a physical job or a job at a desk, you're going to lose a certain amount of wages. So when you add all of these things up, you're talking about a lot of money, you know, and that's just for one case. So that's another good reason not to undertake this unless it's you know, it's necessary. And if it's necessary, you do what you need to do. But if you can get by with simple, conservative measures and solve your problem, this just adds more fuel to that fire, that it's just sensible to take that approach.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Does that help to give you an idea, roughly?
That's great. That's actually very sobering. Like looking at it and going, wow, yeah, there's a lot of aspects that initially it would just seem, well, I'm just going to go get a knee surgery, my knee scoped or have my knee replaced, because that's what, frankly, people that I've worked with, they're like, well, I'm just going to go do it. They are not trying anything. They aren't doing any nutritional modifications or dietary modifications or trying anything outside of the box other than just, it's like either it's black and white for them, either surgery or no surgery.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's always shades of gray. And, as we've discussed, there are times when it's appropriate to say, okay, I'm not going to get any better. I've tried everything else. Now it's appropriate to have surgery. That's far different than just leaping at that as your first expedient.
Right, right. So here's a really good question. The trust of a doctor. If someone is going to a doctor that is proposing knee surgery, how can a person who is in that position, what would you suggest for them to do to determine whether or not they can trust that surgeon
mm-hmm.
to do that surgery?
Well, that's actually that's a very good question. Yeah, to borrow from Ronald Reagan, trust but verify. you need to, first of all, you ask your primary care doctor for a recommendation. Okay? And here's what you say to him once you get the recommendation, because you're going to learn something about your primary care doctor, too, from this. After he gives you the recommendation, say, well, thanks very much. By the way, who do you use for your family?
Ooh.
Okay? And let me tell you something. That's not always the same answer. Okay? And I'm telling you some stuff out of school here. I built my career on word of mouth. In other words, patients would send other patients to me, which, by the way, is the very, very best form of advertising for any surgeon. And there were guys in my town who went to the same church or synagogue or what have you with other guys, and they had a business relationship, and they would send patients to another office, okay? But when it was time for their family, they came to me. And this is why you need to ask the correct question. People don't realize, but there's a lot of the deck stacked against you, and you don't even realize it. If you go to an emergency room, for example, and you say to them, well, listen, I've got this problem, they will look on a roster. They look on a roster, and they say, this is the guy who's on call tonight, and that's who you go to. Well, there is no indication in that roster that anybody is particularly good for your particular problem. It's just everybody who's on in that department has to cover the emergency room, and that's their night in the box. If you want to get the best guy, here's what you do. You ask the nurses. If it's a teaching hospital, you ask the residents, because the interns don't know enough, but the residents do. And you ask the emergency room doctors and nurses who they use for their families. Okay? Mm-hmm. If you ask them for a recommendation, they are ethically bound to say to you, I can't really recommend anybody, or they'll give you three names, or they will give you the guy who's on call. Okay, and it's written right, I mean, it's they're told that it is unethical for them to recommend or steer patients to a given doctor, even if that guy is the best guy. Maybe especially if that guy is the best guy. But if you ask them who they use, that is not unethical, and it's much better indication of who's really good, because you know what? There are going to be the same two or three names that keep coming up. Those are the guys who are top of the heap, because when the chips are down, then and they're not playing politics and they're not following the rules, they're looking after their own asses and those of their family, those are the guys that you want to see.
Mm-hmm.
So then you go to see each one, and then you trust your gut.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now in addition to that, you can go and visit the hospital, and you chat up the nurses. You bring them, so you bring a bunch of coffees up with you. You know, it costs you a few dollars, and the nurses will really appreciate it because they're always overworked and underpaid, and they're underappreciated. And you go up and say, hey, you know, I'm considering having surgery. You know, what do you think of this guy? And you know, you're talking very casually and stuff, and they will tell you more than you could possibly imagine. And again, if the same names keep coming up as, oh, this the guy that I would use, or this is the guy that I sent my mother to, that's who you want. Now, there are other ways to do it, too. You can look up the best surgeons or the best doctors in Castle Connolly, which is the best doctors in whichever region it happens to be. These are two doctors. One guy's a doctor of education. I forget who the other guy is, but Castle and Connolly have these books called The Best Doctors in the U.S., and they have them in different regions, and you can't go wrong at least selecting from among these, because these are doctors selected by their peers as being among the best and the people to whom they would send their families or go themselves. Generally, if you meet a guy and he's got a great reputation, you can rest assured that that reputation has been earned, because it's very easy to lose. You know, reputation takes a lifetime to build and a second to lose. So a guy who's maintaining a great reputation among his peers is somebody that you want taking care of you, because that person is not only technically excellent and well-trained and well-educated, but often will have a great bedside manner. And you will know immediately. It's like meeting somebody and you discover you're going to marry them. Okay? You know. You feel it inside you. And that, when you feel that bond and it's backed up by these other methods that I've told you about, that's the guy you want. And it's also not a bad idea when anybody recommends to get a second or a third opinion. Okay? Does all that help?
That's great. That is phenomenal information. Dr. Bill, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk today. Is there anything else that comes to mind that I didn't cover?
As a matter of fact, we didn't talk much about cruciate ligament reconstructions. But I will tell you just parenthetically that they don't automatically require surgery. If you're a high performance athlete, yes, okay, yeah, then you do need reconstruction. But if you're an average guy and you've only got instability in some activities of daily living, and you don't mind using a brace when you play and stuff like that, that it's conservative treatment is perfectly appropriate for that person. I would ask you and your listeners to remember that surgery is not designed to restore you to quote-unquote normal. You know, you just can't make an 80-year-old knee a 20-year-old knee. You just can't do it. Surgery is actually meant to approximate normal. And whether that's a scope or an ACL reconstruction or a patella realignment or a partial or total knee replacement, a post-surgical knee is never, never 100%. if you've got a really good surgeon and you're highly motivated and you work hard at physical therapy and exercise, you might get into the high 90%, but not 100%. And so once surgery is done, there's always some scar tissue which is less compliant and stiffer than a virgin knee. And so you're always going to have a slight feeling of stiffness and a slight ache with damp weather for maybe a year or two after surgery, even if everything goes well. So you have to realize that that's normal or expected after surgery. And it's also another thing I would recommend is that if you ever do need to get surgery, it's vitally important to recover your full range of motion as quickly as you can, because that makes all the difference. It makes you have less pain, less swelling, a more rapid and a more complete recovery, and brings you closer to normal faster. And if you have end-stage osteoarthritis of the hip and the knee on the same side, always do the hip first. And the reason for that is because hip pain can refer down to the knee, as I mentioned before. And when you do a hip replacement, it alters the angle for aligning a total knee. So it makes a difference in terms of you know, how you feel and you know, how you're ultimately going to do. So I think everybody needs to remember that although surgery can be of great benefit and restore function and relieve pain, it's not a benign procedure, and it should only be done if truly indicated and if all other non-surgical options have really been exhausted. So my recommendation would be to, you know, be suspicious, involve your doctor early, you know, be sure you're operating on an objective evaluation, and recognize that in most circumstances, but not all circumstances, there's no immediate need for surgery. So try the conservative things first, give your body a chance to heal, and maybe you too will be able to get better and avoid surgery.
Great. That's fantastic information, fantastic advice. Dr. Bill, thank you so much for being on the call today. One of the reasons that I was really interested about interviewing you about this was your book, How to Avoid Knee Surgery. And we've set up a special link for the listeners of the call, and they can go to thekneepainguru.com/no-knee-surgery. That's NOKNEESURGERY. So once again, Dr. Bill, thank you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And have a wonderful day.
You too. All the best.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.